people outside of New Zealand do use. And the interesting part of being a product attorney, at least at Microsoft, the way we work is you actually are embedded with the engineers. So I learned a new style of dress from my law firm, but I actually spent a lot of time in privacy reviews and security reviews. And so I have a lot of experience just in how our products are built. So anyway, a little background about me and Russell.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. So I'm Russell Craig. I'm Microsoft's National Technology Officer. And like Michael, I thought I don't want to be left out of Ignite. So when Rod down the back there was putting the track together, we said we'd love to talk about the trust story and Trusted Cloud, because we think this is a really important story for our customers and our partners to understand. So just very, very quickly, my background with Microsoft is not nearly as long as Michael's. I've been with Microsoft for about a year and a half. Prior to that, quite a long experience in the technology industry offshore, and then many years in government. And I think why that's relevant is I've walked in the customer's shoes, and I have, on occasion, held responsibilities where trust was really quite central to your thinking about technology. For example, I was the privacy officer for the National Health Information Collections for a few years when I worked in health. So for me, to think about and talk about trust is really quite central to the broader conversations we have about what technologies should we adopt, why should we adopt them, how do we understand the risks, how do we mitigate those risks, how do we get comfortable with what we're doing. So hopefully you'll find this discussion really interesting. What Michael and I are going to try and do, because we both have a big role to play in sharing this story in New Zealand, we'll try and bounce back and forward and get a bit of a dialogue going here on the stage. So over to you, Michael, ready to kick us off.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we start, has anyone ever asked themselves this question or been asked by a customer yet? And do you trust your cloud provider personally?
No.
No? All right. Well, maybe we'll try and change. If it's Microsoft, maybe we'll try and change that today.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's interesting feedback. And you may not then be surprised that we are talking about cloud and cloud services in the context of trust. But probably what you're alluding to, what everyone's alluding to, is really people do not use technology that they don't trust, right? Just like you don't put your money, I assume, in a bank that you don't trust. And really, you know, how we got on, onto this topic, although it's a pretty new topic, new over the last couple of years.
Well, with cloud, yeah.
With
sure.
Cloud, yeah. Certainly. But I guess trust is always a question, you know, you ask about your technology provider,
yeah.
IT provider. But one of the things that's happened, you know, more recently, somewhat recently, in the context of cloud, is Mr. Snowden. I would assume that most people in this room are familiar with it. If you haven't been living under a rock, familiar with this man, Edward Snowden. He's a man of sort of international intrigue, if you will. For those of you who might not know who he is, in June of 2013, he stole four laptops, hopped on a plane, flew to Hong Kong. He had connected with Glenn Greenwald from the Guardian newspaper in the UK and started releasing tens of thousands of documents about government surveillance. Interesting fact that I actually learned earlier in the week when I was preparing for this a bit is that he at the NSA, Edward was a SharePoint administrator, right? Which is kind of interesting.
So do you trust your SharePoint administrator?
So do you trust, exactly, absolutely. Do you trust your SharePoint? That's what we should have named the presentation. And so since that time, since the release of those documents, many of which seem to implicate, you know, major multinational, generally American technology companies, including Microsoft. Myself, other attorneys at Microsoft around the world, other national technology officers around the globe have been having conversations like this, talking about trust, trying to, I guess, restore trust, not only in Microsoft, but into the cloud generally. Because as you've probably heard a few times, certainly if you were at Ignite last night, we were talking all about Microsoft's transformation to the cloud,
yeah.
Right? And you know, before we used to just license software, you could go to Noleeming and pick it up off the shelf. We still license software, right? We license services, but we, you know, increasingly do so from the cloud. And in addition, we also ask that you trust us with your data or your customers' data, right? So anyway, that's just a little bit of background about how we started down this trust journey. We call this story the trusted cloud story. But it's not just about government surveillance, right? Edward Snowden and government surveillance. Yeah. It's also about cybersecurity.
Cybersecurity, yeah. So on the one hand, we've got Edward Snowden and everything he's sort of shown the world about government surveillance. And if you're really familiar with that story, then you'll understand that Microsoft has had to really deal with that in a very sort of on the front foot kind of way, because along with many other vendors in the cloud space, there were, you know, various allegations and implications. Now, you might think this has been terrible for us, but I've heard a lot of very senior people in the company say, actually, this existential challenge has been great for us, because it's really sort of made us focus on this question and talk to our customers and work out how we're going to differentiate our services, our products, and really inspire the trust that our customers need. The other thing, unless you've been asleep, that's going on, and I know none of you have, is the rising tide of cybercrime. And so the risks are multiplying. Any vendor will be showing you this type of slide if they're touching on cybersecurity. Some of the statistics that we're now sort of seeing are really very disturbing. For example, the fact that on average, the median time an attacker is inside an environment before they're discovered is over 200 days. I believe actually the number is 246 days. So there's an incredible amount of cybersecurity risk affecting many of our customers, many of whom, of course, have been compromised. Many don't know that they've been compromised, but they have been. So when you think about that and other aspects of this rising tide of cybercrime, and then you think about the question of, well, should I actually be moving my ICT environment to the cloud or making use of cloud services? What does that mean for me in terms of the potential risks that I'm exposing myself to? We're constantly sort of seeing stories in the media, and if you just move the slide on a wee bit, you know, it's always interesting to highlight the cyber risk stories du jour, if you like. We're all familiar with the Ashley Madison story. I was trying to work out, actually, where was Ashley Madison storing their data? They weren't storing it in our cloud. I don't think this would have happened necessarily if they had been, but it's highly likely if you're invested in Ashley Madison, you're wishing you didn't have an investment, because I think that business is pretty much history and the CEO's resigned. On the other side of the picture, if you like, is the story that emerged in April, May, June this year of the Office of Personnel Management in the US losing up to 22 million personnel records out of a system that they were running. That's an incredible breach of national security. So there's a whole bunch of bad actors that now have access to information that's highly prejudicial to the operations of the US government. Will no doubt lead to many breaches of national security, because suddenly you've got 22 million potential past and present employees who could somehow be vulnerable to having pressure applied to them, because you know a lot about their background. So this combination of, well, what's happening with government surveillance, what's happening with cybersecurity, what are the risks that we're facing, what does it all mean when we're looking at moving to cloud? These are some of the big sort of existential challenges that lead us to be talking about trust with our customers.
Yeah, yeah. And so, the logical next question is then, how do you decide who to trust? Because certainly choosing your cloud provider is going to have a huge impact on your business, on your organization's business. So, how do you choose your cloud provider? In many ways, it's a similar question, and these attributes that we've sort of outlined here, which we think are important, are very similar to, you know, how do you choose your child's daycare, right? Or how do you choose your partner? How do you choose a babysitter? How do you choose your bank? It's very, very similar attributes. So what we're going to sort of unpack now and over the remaining time that we have, I can see that the timer is counting down, is really going over a set of foundational beliefs that we've developed that help guide the way that Microsoft does business in the cloud.
Yeah.
And you can talk a bit more about the attributes that matter and that foundation.
So I think those sort of attributes or considerations on the previous slide. These are the sorts of questions you'd be asking yourself when you're looking at procuring any kind of, you know, IT, any kind of ICT procurement software, hardware, or a service. So those things, and I don't know whether you sort of took a good look at them, they probably all seem pretty familiar to you. So what we've been doing
I can go back real quick.
Oh, great. Thanks. Yeah, so I mean, is there anything in that slide that jumps out as unusual to you? I'm imagining not. Is there anything that you would suggest that's not on that slide that should be? I think it's reasonably comprehensive. So if we can just move on again.
Yep.
So that's fine, but there are things that are different about the cloud, particularly, I guess, different about so-called hyperscale public cloud service providers such as Microsoft and one or two others in the industry. And so as we've talked this through with our customers and our partners, what we've come to understand, we think, is that of all these attributes, there are really three sort of broad things that matter the most and that sort of merit you thinking hard about when you're choosing or thinking about a cloud service provider. And those are, firstly, what are the sort of principles that organization espouses around building a trusted cloud and building trusted services? What are the things that they tell you are the sort of North Stars or the things that guide them in doing what they do, and importantly, the things that tell them what they oughtn't to do as a cloud service provider or as an engineer of a cloud service? Secondly, and equally importantly, we think it's really important, and this reflects our sort of heritage of, you know, 40 years in this industry, it's really important that if you're going to, you know, entrust your business to a cloud service provider, either entirely or in part, then we think it's really important that provider has a solid enterprise-ready sort of foundation of skills and experience and knows what it takes to provide enterprise-grade services to your organization. And I guess while we focus on this, obviously, in the cloud era, there are many entrants who have arrived recently, born in the cloud, and don't necessarily have that long heritage of providing enterprise-grade services and products, and we think that's really important. And thirdly, we think it's also really important that the cloud service provider that you're looking to go with is showing leadership in the industry in a variety of ways. And we'll go into that towards the end of the presentation. In particular, we want to share with you some of the things that Microsoft is standing up and doing and saying around some of these big issues that we've just sort of identified for you that we think are really quite important in terms of your ability to trust your provider.
So we'll start first with the trusted cloud principles. And you can probably tell by my accent that I didn't grow up here and I didn't grow up in Canada. I grew up in the U.S. You know, in the U.S., we have the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. As a school kid in the U.S., we had to learn the preamble to the Constitution, you know, yeah, which is "We the People." It was a song, actually. "In order to form a more perfect union." I won't go any further. But that's really how we think about the sort of the trusted cloud principles or the Bill of Rights of the cloud. And it's really around what you can and should expect, what an enterprise-grade organization can expect from their cloud provider. And it's really, truly around protecting your data, making certain that your data is secure. From a privacy and controls perspective, it's about you deciding what gets done with your data, you providing the consent to use your data in any way, shape, or form. And an example of that would be, you know, some cloud providers do scan data, scan email for advertising purposes. If you're okay with that, that's fine, but you should be able to make that determination. Compliance is important in terms of, you know, different industries, as you know, have different regulatory requirements that they need to comply with. Certainly, banks, healthcare, you know, et cetera, law enforcement, all have different regulatory regimes and audit requirements. And so you should expect that your cloud provider will help you comply with those requirements. And finally, transparency. You should know where your data is. I mean, is it in Ohio? Is it in Indonesia? You know, is it in the Ukraine? You should know at all times where your data is and understand the rules around how your cloud provider, how and when your cloud provider can access that data. So again, we'll go through these principles in a bit more depth in an interesting way, so don't be alarmed. Not time, hopefully, to go and find another presentation yet. Quickly on privacy, and some of these in particular, I think with privacy are obvious. Maybe obvious to me because I used to sit through hundreds and hundreds of hours of privacy reviews for every product release at Microsoft. Sit in a room with engineers, and they had to explain to the lawyer, that was me, you know, where the data was going and who had access to it and how it was being used. And so, from a privacy perspective, again, building on as one of the core principles, you should know. And you should always be in a position to give to consent to how your data is used. The other key point really is around restricting access to the data, both from employees of your cloud provider, but also from subcontractors. Because the reality is, although Microsoft and Amazon and Google, Salesforce, and other cloud providers all have a lot of data centers around the world, and we'll talk a bit more about that and the locations, data centers are often not owned actually by the cloud provider, right? So they lease the space, they bring in subcontractors to work on that. So you should understand and expect to know, does your cloud provider use subcontractors in the data center? One of the ways that you can find some assurance in this area is looking at the international certifications that your cloud provider has. The one that you hear talked about most generally is ISO standard 27001. Again, not a super sexy topic, but nonetheless super important. And the interesting thing, though, over the last couple years, as we, Russell and I, have worked with ISO standard 27001, it's useful and it's helpful, but it wasn't designed around the cloud, right? Mm-hmm. And around the storage of data.
Yeah.
Earlier this year, if you follow this space, you would be aware, and if you're not, you should be aware that ISO standard, it's really a substandard of 27001, it's 27018, has been sort of promulgated. And it's the first standard which deals with how a cloud provider, how an IT vendor, whatever you want to call them, how they handle personally identifiable information. Microsoft was the first cloud provider in the world to be certified in accordance with this standard. And what was the other one we were talking about
Dropbox
this morning?
Yeah, Dropbox for Business has just achieved the certification. So we now can't say we're the only provider to have achieved this. But I guess it's good to see other vendors doing this. This is, and I think we'll see many more, except those that when you look at some of the things that you need to be able to commit to, there are some cloud providers that will never be able to achieve this unless they change their business models. It's
a good question.
It's a code of practice. You achieve a certification that you are aligned to the requirements of the code of practice as a consequence of the ISO 27001 audit process that we at least go through on an annual basis. So it's the same auditors who, when they come through and do 27001, take a look at your processes and take a look at, in particular, your contractual arrangements, and we'll be able to give an attestation that says, yes, your practices comply with ISO 27001-8.
And the key point is something you just said on that is that you have to, the certification requires that you actually contractually offer certain things. So it's not just about having it in your marketing material or on your website. There has to be sort of independent verification in your contracts as well.
Yeah.
In addition to your systems.
Yeah.
Some of the key points are, are you in control of your data? Are customers of a cloud provider required to give consent to do anything with the data? You can read read the slide, but it's really around, you know, knowing what's happening with your data, you know, having certain de minimis security precautions in place. And as we'll discuss a bit further too, it's really around, and this is a result of the, you know, Edward Snowden, of Mr. Snowden, yeah. It's knowing when law enforcement or you know, some part of the government is asking for access to your account,
yeah.
right? To your email account, yeah. et cetera.
And some of us get super excited about this stuff. And it's this last point, if we track it all the way back to Edward Snowden, so what have we had to deal with since then? A lot of sort of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and genuine concern. Well, what the heck is Microsoft doing? Have they got the NSA turning up on a regular basis saying, handing over data? Well, firstly, we're telling you, we don't do that. Then we make contractual commitments to you that we don't do that, and this has now been certified that, yes, they make these commitments. So if we actually are handing over data to law enforcement and not telling you about that, then you've got significant legal comeback.
Yep.
So, you know, again, there's lots of different elements that feed into the question of can I trust a cloud service provider, and we think this question of contractual commitments, and we'll deal with this a wee bit more, is one of the most important.
Yeah, and you know, I spend a lot, in addition to my day job doing presentations, I actually spend a lot of time in rooms with lawyers from our customers, you know, sort of going through explaining and negotiating these terms. So I know that particular, you know, with a lot of most of our customers, these are in fact very important questions. These are the type of questions and concerns that your legal teams will have, your risk committees in your organizations will have, and increasingly the types of questions that board of directors will be asking. So one of the principles you probably remember is transparency. And so we're going to just focus for a few minutes here on where is my data? Because the interesting thing is, and you should start asking this question, a lot of people will not tell you or are unable to tell you where your data is located. So this slide sort of highlights the different regions where Microsoft has data centers. We have over 100 data centers sprinkled around the world. It was in 40 countries,
40
I think.
40 countries, yeah.
In 40 countries to date. Up until October of last year, when we opened the Australian data centers, which I can sort of go to for a second here. As you may know, Microsoft now has one data center in Sydney and one in Melbourne. Prior to opening those last year, if you were a customer in New Zealand, the default position was that Singapore and Hong Kong were your data centers and is where your data would be located and stored, and the services would be offered from. And it's important to note, and you may be aware of this as well, that Microsoft has a practice whereby we call it geo-redundancy.
Yeah.
I'll trip over that, or geo-replication. And so in each region, in each sub-region, there are always two data centers, generally hundreds of miles apart, right? And there are, I think, six instances of your data between the two data centers. So again, default position, you go online to Microsoft Office 365, you're here in New Zealand, your data will be stored in these two data centers. You can choose different data centers if you want. Obviously, potentially, there could be latency yeah. implications to that. But a lot of international companies like an Air New Zealand, right, may have, and so you have subsidiaries, employees in different parts of the world and can rely on and use different data centers. Yeah.
So we think this is really, really important. As Michael was saying, some of our competitors are fairly sort of guarded about where your data is, and it's very difficult to find out. We figure, well, we've got no reason not to tell you where your data is located. And in fact, you know, if you're really interested, we'll allow you to come visit our data centers. I've not been to one myself. Apparently the data center guys get kind of excited. Everyone else is going, I'm not sure what I'm seeing here. Big building, few guys pushing a broom, you know, maybe a technician or two. Most of the action, of course, is off-site in secure facilities. But we'll allow you to come to the data centers to satisfy your own curiosity about how we're operating, what are the physical security arrangements look like, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's not like going to Disneyland, but you have to sign a confidentiality agreement, and there's a few other implications. But
Certainly in China, we're operating an instance of Azure, but in that case, it operates on a different basis. So only Chinese customers can use that instance of Azure, and it's operated by a third party for various legal reasons that keep both the US and Chinese officials happy. And so it's part of the Azure cloud infrastructure, but it's an environment all of itself. So it's entirely separated from the rest of the world. India, I think, has just shaded that way to say we actually are planning data centers. And as for the rest of it, I'm not entirely sure what the shading means, to tell you the truth.
So transparency on response to data requests. Again, this has become a big issue in the post-Snowden era. And as the lawyer for Microsoft New Zealand, if the New Zealand government or the New Zealand police want to request information, if they obtain a warrant, they email it to me, that comes into my inbox, and it goes, I then send it over to Microsoft Corporation. We have a whole team of people in Microsoft who, in our legal unit, who sit down and review subpoenas and warrants from around the world. Again, it's a process that is certified as part of the ISO 27018 review. But it's become a really big issue as part in the post-Snowden era, and as part of this trust discussion. Microsoft has taken the position that in order to, again, to be certified with 27018, we have to set forth exactly how in our contracts we will respond to data requests. And you can see those highlighted there with the three bulleted areas. But the premise is, we are just a custodian of the data. We don't do anything with the data. We don't scan it for advertising. We don't peek at it. We don't make any money off of it other than we hold it, and we hold it securely. If government or law enforcement wants to access your data, they may only do so under a legally accepted means. We review that request, but our modus operandi, our first port of call is you as the customer, because it is your data. And so we try where we can to redirect law enforcement directly to you. That said, as important as this topic is, and as of great, and it is of something that is of concern, I should say, to our customers, in reality, the statistic, and this might be about 6 months old, is that we have, I think, roughly 20 million cloud customers around the world. Of those 20 million cloud customers, enterprise cloud customers. Thank you. I think it's a billion.
Not consumers.
It's a billion when you add in consumers, but 20 million enterprise cloud customers. We've received 19 warrants to obtain information from those 20 million accounts, and those 19 warrants actually affected, I think, about 48 accounts. Of those 19 warrants, we had to turn over information affecting 5 customers. And that was only in the United States. Microsoft has never had to or been asked to turn over information for enterprise customers outside the United States. So that sort of puts it puts it in context.
And Michael, perhaps it's worth noting actually that this we actually took the US government to court and won the right to publish all the requests that we get from the US government for access to customer data. And we now publish on a 6-monthly basis what I think we call our transparency report.
Transparency law report.
Transparency law report, which sort of pulls together all the requests that we get from all governments around the world every 6 months.
Yep. So if you go online and Bing it, Microsoft Transparency Law Report, you can find the number of law enforcement requests that we get from New Zealand and I think most countries around the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great law school exam question, but generally the way you should think about it is the primary entity that would have access to that is the jurisdiction in which your data resides. So if your data is in a data center in Australia, most likely, you know, the likeliest cause is probably, you know, the Australian government, right? And they would have to seek some type of warrant. That said, the New Zealand government can, you know, also seek to obtain that data, but because it's held offshore, they would have to coordinate, the police here would have to obtain a warrant. They would then have to, you know, in theory, contact the Australian government as well. Let me give you a real life hypothetical, which is this next slide. So about a year ago, the team that I mentioned before, the legal team in Washington that reviews the international warrants, warrants that come in for customer data from Microsoft, we received a U.S. domestic warrant from the Department of Justice. The interesting piece of that, and it was something that we had never experienced before, is that the request was actually for emails, I believe from a Hotmail account. Those emails belong to a gentleman who's an Irish citizen. He lives in Ireland, I believe in Dublin. His emails, his Hotmail account, those emails are actually stored at the Microsoft data center in Ireland, right? Absolutely no ties to the United States whatsoever. But the US government said, hey, you're Microsoft. You guys, you know, somebody, an engineer in Redmond can flick the switch, right, and pull those emails from Dublin. So therefore, you're in control of them. We're going to use a U.S. domestic warrant. And we said, no, it doesn't work that way. You know, a U.S. warrant can only be enforced in the United States. The Department of Justice couldn't send a U.S. marshal on a plane to Dublin with the warrant to go knock on the guy's door, right? Say, hey, let me search your house. It doesn't work that way. Unfortunately, when we refused to turn the emails over, we were sued by the U.S. government. We lost the first round in the U.S. Federal District Court in Second Circuit in New York. We've appealed it, and the hearings are next week, actually, I believe, unless they've been postponed recently. They've been scheduled for September 9th at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan. So it's still a developing area. Yeah. But where Microsoft is coming out and a lot of the technology companies from around the world who have filed amicus curiae briefs supporting us, and also actually the Irish government has filed a brief supporting Microsoft as well, you know, the idea is that governments should work through existing legal processes, right, for requesting information. So forget the cloud, right? If the New Zealand government wants to get information about someone, and that information, whatever it is held in Australia, even before the cloud existed, they would operate through what's called a mutual legal assistance treaty. And one government calls the other government and says, hey, this is what's going on, this is the warrant, this is what we need. That's how it should work. And to the extent that it doesn't, you know, Microsoft is doing a lot of work, mm-hmm. Our legal team and government affairs teams yeah. are doing a lot of work around the world to try and keep governments yeah. honest. And if, you know, if we need to change the laws, then we should work through, you know, sort of democratic legal yeah. processes to do that.
And I think, yeah.
What's that?
Mm-hmm.
No, so I mean Sarbanes-Oxley is our laws that Microsoft is required to act in compliance with, but not our customers, and also I mean that's a very short answer to your question, but the answer is no. As a customer, you don't have to act in accordance with them per se, unless you're otherwise legally required to do so, but you know, not because you use our cloud. In terms of the Patriot Act, which is a question that we used to get asked a lot about, not so much anymore, But the Patriot Act is really, to combat counterterrorism. So to the extent that you are involved in a business or somehow, money laundering stuff and trying to use our cloud to hide stuff or store stuff, you would be subject to the Patriot Act. But if you're not, if you're not involved in terrorism, it's not really an issue, right?
What did you say? You sell?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you never know what you can do with one of those, enough. Well, I think what's equally clear, though, from this case and others is, and let's go back to it, we said at the beginning, we think of all the different attributes. What's the position that a cloud service provider is taking in terms of industry leadership?
Yep.
So we've said in this case, no, we're not handing over the data. Go through the Irish government. We'll go all the way to the Supreme Court to defend our customers' right to not have their data handed over by their cloud service provider, which we think is wrong. It's an evolving body of law.
If you did hand over that data in the Irish case,
yeah,
then could I, as the Irishman concerned, sue Microsoft Ireland for breach of contract in releasing that data to a third party? Because after all, Microsoft Ireland was not required by to hand it over.
It probably gets a little bit more complex because the individual in question is using a free Hotmail account.
So it's a consumer service.
Yeah. And generally what we're talking about here today and in terms of contractual commitments belong to or are made to enterprise customers. Yeah, but
and we do hand data over. A very good example is what happened with the Charlie Hebdo shootings or killings in Paris at the beginning of this year. So in that case, the French authorities said, we've got to try and find out who these perpetrators are. We think they've got Hotmail accounts. Let's talk to the FBI. The FBI came to the same team with a request, and we looked at it and we said, that's a legal, lawful request for data and there's potentially life at stake and what have you. So there's a whole bunch of decision tests that we make, and within 45 minutes, the French authorities were in possession of the Hotmail accounts of those people. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
well, and. Well, indeed, and actually this thing about being pushed around, again, when you're looking at a cloud service provider, you need to ask yourself, what lengths will that cloud service provider go to protect me? What are their resources to protect me? How many service providers, in the face of a request from the Department of Justice to respond to a warrant, would just hand data over quietly? Versus saying, no, guess what, we'll go all the way to the Supreme Court because we think that's wrong.
It would have been a lot easier just to turn it over. If you, there's a million different variations. The short answer is really you are under the jurisdiction of New Zealand or Australia, really, at the end of the day, right? But the reality is whether it's the U.S. government or the New Zealand government or the, Indonesian government or whomever, governments can ask for what they want. So absolutely, if you're a New Zealand citizen, and we're getting a little bit short on your slide, so I'll answer this quickly. If a New Zealand citizen here, is doing business somewhere or it's implicated, say, in a lawsuit in the United States, certainly the party, if one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit is in the United States and they sue to obtain or discover, certain information, Absolutely, under a mutual legal assistance treaty, they can request that information from the New Zealand government, from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade here. They'd probably go through the embassy in the U.S., and they would work out whether or not New Zealand has to turn over that information. That could happen inside the cloud. That can happen outside the cloud, right? So I think part of the issue is that... And the other point is they'd even have to know that you had stuff in the cloud to begin with, which I don't know how they'd know that, but they might, right? They might figure it out. But part of the issue here is they're great questions because it's really trying to unpack, the different layers. But what we're also trying to do, and it may be working well or not so well, is to help people understand that there is a paradigm that we operate under. We are transparent about that. We set forth in our contracts, and other cloud providers do too. Some do a good job, others don't. But really trying to be crisp about what the issues are and how to solve them and how to protect your data. Because many of these questions are questions of first instance, right? And we'll see how the warrant case plays out, but we are gonna keep fighting it, right? And I think over time, these issues of data sovereignty will either become clearer, right, as to how they work and how they operate as we have more cases. But also, I think that probably people may become less concerned about them. Certainly, we've seen that with the Patriot Act, right? You really don't need to be concerned about the Patriot Act unless you're, doing money laundering, like I said, or some terrorist act. But that often is, there was a question, that I used to get asked a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does a New Zealand or Australian court have to be in the loop, or can they be top right of that? If somebody goes straight to Microsoft,
yeah.
US, which is what you sort of said was happening in that Irish case.
Well, no, what they were trying to do, yeah.
Yeah.
But what they weren't able to accomplish. Yep.
To sort of round it out, and again, we could talk about this for hours, right? And we will be talking about it for
Russell and I will be here all afternoon if you guys are free after this.
And I think you can tell from the conversation we've had, we do deal with this a lot globally. But again, we'd really encourage you to go and take a look at our transparency report. Because in the context of the Patriot Act, what is it, 19 requests over the whole of that time?
Yep.
Right? And only X number actually responded to. But it's all there to be discovered. And when you put that into context, and then you ask yourself, okay, well, can I trust my cloud provider, and also can I trust the cloud per se? So there's the absolute risk, and then there's actual, in real terms, what is the scale of the risk that I'm exposed to here? And we would say vanishingly low. Look at the statistics, the number of requests, and then think about how we at least would respond to those requests, and then you can make your own judgment.
Can I tell a really quick story?
Yeah, sure.
30 seconds.
Whatever.
I know we're...
Go
I'm cutting into his slides.
Yeah.
I was doing a similar type presentation probably 6 months ago, and one of the questions from the audience was, but what do you do about drone attacks? And I was like, holy shit, I hadn't thought of that.
Cowered right? Under the desk.
Cowered under the... what do we do about drone attacks? And the only thing I could think to say was, all hell's going to break loose, right, when we're dealing with drone attacks. So we we don't have a drone attack policy.
Countermeasures policy, yeah.
We have spent, more time trying to work through all the different data sovereignty issues. So, absolutely happy to walk through them. Because there are lots of, it depends. But I think the final point for me on that is that it shouldn't be as big of a concern as it is to people, and it generally isn't once you walk through you know, the paradigm and how it how it works.
But you absolutely should be able to ask these questions of your provider and have some sense of getting a sensible, robust answer rather than just being dismissed. So so if we can move along.
Yeah, I'll move over.
From all the craziness of governments wanting to get access to your data, aside from the things that we do in the privacy domain and we do to be sort of really transparent about what we do and we don't do with your data and how we handle requests for law enforcement, what we will and won't do and how far we will go to defend your interests, obviously you also need to have confidence in a cloud service provider in regard to the cybersecurity practices or just the security practices. We don't have time here to go into depth on all of Microsoft's security practices, but I'm very confident in standing in front of any audience and saying that the lengths that we go to build and operate a secure cloud are extraordinary, unprecedented, industry-leading, and partly that's because we have the sheer capacity. When you're operating at hyperscale, you know, we're running well over 1 million servers, goodness knows how many cores, 100 data centers around the world. We've got an economy of scale and scope that we bring to the table that most of our competitors don't. And so we've got deep expertise that we can draw on. We've got deep pockets that we can use to invest all the way from physical security to operational practices and everything in between. We've got a very strong culture around privacy by design as part of, you know, how we build all our products these days. It always really has been, but it's increasingly important. And a very strong culture around security practices. Since 2002, we've had in place a program called Trustworthy Computing. Some of you may well be aware of it. It was a response to a memo that Bill Gates wrote to the company saying, if we don't build better, more secure software, we don't have a future as a business. And out of that effort came something called the Secure Development Lifecycle, which now informs the way that we build all our software and services. And you know, we're quite proud of the fact that it's really become the de facto industry standard for secure development. It is codified under a standard ISO 42000 something or other. So the secure development lifecycle is one example of how security is really embedded into the fabric of our business. As I was saying, you know, we invest, you know, incredible amounts in the security of our data centers and the ways in which we operate. You know, the physical security of our data centers is extraordinary. But I think some of the practices, our operational security practices, are worth noting. One is the fact that we run on a least privileges basis. So for any administrator in Microsoft to get access to your data, the procedure today is they have to go to an administrator and say, I need to access so-and-so's data. I've got to do a job on the virtual machine or something like that. And their manager will look at that and they'll either give approval or not. Once approval is given, they will be given a sort of timed access. So they might get 1 hour on the server to go and do the job. While they're on the server doing the job, they are being logged and monitored. Every keystroke is being monitored and that's all archived, so it can be audited in the future if there's any reason to call into question what has happened on that server during that hour. We're going to go another step with that pretty soon. What we'll be doing is once the manager of that administrator is given approval for them to go and do whatever they need to do.